never less than 10 letters, and more often more like 15 or something. And it wasn't even German, though I didn't know enough German that it would have done me any good if it had been, but it looked like German. At this time, I don't believe those airplanes had any guns in them at all, though they had had some in there originally. The landing gear was retractable, but after we wrecked a couple of them by landing and then having the landing gear collapse, the order went out that we were not to retract the landing gear. I flew that airplane quite a bit because they were always around. You could fly it if you wanted to, and the enlisted men liked to go for rides. And I'd take them up and ride around and practice landing and screw around. And never had any trouble with that airplane at all. We also had one Australian fighter plane. They called it a fighter plane. It was called a Hirraway. Hirraway, one word. Now, it was nothing but a copycat AT-6. But it had a fatal flaw in it, as far as I'm concerned, and that was that whereas an AT-6, I think that was on his final approach one day while we were there, one of our guys, a boy by the name of Rowe, spun in. And in my own mind, I'm certain that he put down full flaps. And I've flown that airplane, and I know what it's like when you put down full flaps. And I think he didn't have enough airspeed to sustain that sudden slow-up. And in he went. It burned. He was killed, of course. And there was a funeral down in Newcastle. I remember being impressed because as the funeral procession went down the street, all the Australian military soldiers and whatnot who happened to be in town along the street stopped and saluted as the procession went by. Fortunately, that's the only person we lost in that OTU. And eventually, by God, I got to fly a fighter, which is a P-39. That's about as good a fighter as you will ever get to check out in, because it's not hard to fly. It had a tricycle landing gear. I'd never flown an airplane with a tricycle landing gear before. And some people may remember the P-39 was unique in some ways. First place, the engine was behind the pilot, not in front. It had an Allison engine in it. The propeller was driven by a draft shaft which ran through the cockpit floor between your legs and up to the nose. And in the middle of the propeller, there was a 37-millimeter cannon. This airplane had peculiar armament, and it was one of its weaknesses. There was one 37-millimeter cannon in the nose. There were two 50-caliber machine guns in the nose, which fired through the propeller. And there were either two or four, I forget which, four, I think, 30-caliber machine guns, two in each wing. What's wrong with that? Well, what's wrong with it is that you've got three different kinds of guns with three different rates of fire, three different trajectories. That's the main problem. The 30-caliber machine guns aren't worth a damn in air-to-air combat. They aren't big enough to hurt anybody much, and they're practically useless. Nevertheless, that's what we had. But in the ones we were using down at Williamtown, they didn't have any guns in them at all, I don't suppose. If they did, they certainly didn't have any ammunition. We didn't have any anything. And to keep our ears from getting hurt by the noise, because there are no mufflers on those engines, and they're 12-cylinder engines, we would always stick cotton in our ears. You see, otherwise you'd wear a helmet with headphones in the helmet, and that would muffle the noise, but we didn't have any such stuff as that. So we would just take them up there with cotton stuffed in her ears. And I remember well the first time I was allowed to fly this P-39. I was terribly excited about it. And I went out and started it up. Of course, I'd done that in practice sometimes before already. And taxied out and took off. I didn't have any trouble with anything, actually. Flew around all right. And people told me later that when I came in to land, I expect the landing was a little bit long. But anyway, they said, Major Lundy stood there watching, and he said, "Don't land it, don't land it, don't land it. Oh, what a beautiful landing." I had plenty of runway left. I wasn't even conscious that there was any problem. There evidently wasn't much of one. Anyway, I was highly elated about that, and I remember saying when I got out of the airplane, "Well, no matter what happens to me now, I can always say I've flown a fighter." Well, we flew those airplanes as much as we could, and some of them got wrecked. One of them, the engine quit right after takeoff, and that got wrecked, though it didn't hurt anybody. And one of them, a boy named Jarman, landed with the landing gear not all the way down. Now, that airplane had a warning horn, so that if you cut the throttle back all the way and the landing gear was not down or not all the way down, this horn would blare at you and give you a clue that something was wrong, and you're supposed to know what was wrong. Well, he landed it with the landing gear halfway down, and he got down and ran along the runway a little bit, and then the nose wheel collapsed, and the thing went up on its nose and bent the prop and all that stuff. It didn't hurt old Charman. He got out there, and he told Major Lundy that he didn't know the landing gear wasn't down. And Major Lundy went out, and he opened the door and got in there, and he turned on the switch, and he pulled the throttle back all the way, and this horn let out a big blast. And Major Lundy got out. He said, "That's all I wanted to know." We didn't get any formation flying or anything like that. I did probably some foolish things with that airplane, and I remember one landing one, and it wasn't in a cow pasture. Now, that's not so, but it was in a dirt field, disused dirt field some miles away. Didn't have any problem, nothing happened, but there was an old farmer over there, and he came up. I got out, and the farmer came up and talked to me, and he apparently more or less recognized this airplane because the nickname and the thing that British and Australians always called the P-39 was an Era Cobra. That was the name of it. Well, he said, "That's a Cobra, is it? A Cobra?" "It was a Cobra." "All right." We even on one occasion were crazy enough, we had nothing much to do most of the time anyhow, crazy enough to take one of those wrecked P-39s, take the wing off of it, take the wing off another wrecked one, and put it on the first plane. Now, I don't know who would have flown an airplane that ignoramuses like us had rigged. But somebody did. Eventually, when we left there, they flew it up to Brisbane and it got away with it. There was another incident that took place at Williamtown, which made a great impression on me at the time. At this field, there were 2 4-engine bombers. First, there was what was called an LB-30. And that was nothing but a B-24 made over into a sort of cargo-carrying B-24. And that airplane flew back and forth between the USA and Australia with diplomatic pouches and such. And it seemed to be based at Williamtown. I very seldom saw it fly. It wasn't even there most of the time, but it would come and go. Also based there, for what reason I don't fully understand, was a B-17. And that B-17 had its own crew, a captain who looked like Blackburn Kemper for all the world and was built like him. Short, heavy-set, good-looking fellow. and a co-pilot and a crew chief. I don't know if there's any more than those three. I don't think there's anybody but those three. And my understanding was that they used this B-17 to tow targets for gunnery practice for the Australians. But where they did it, I don't know. I never saw them take off with a target or land with one. I never saw. I don't know where they would have gone for that, but that's what my understanding was. Anyhow, be that as it may, one day Major Lundy came to me and also to another boy named Duncan Myers. Duncan Myers, by the way, is still alive, and he lives over on the eastern shore of Maryland. Has invited me repeatedly to come see him, and I'll do that someday. He's set up now, of course, he's retired from the military, and he's set up as he has a visiting card which announces himself as a consultant. And I said, Dunk, what is a consultant? He said, well, I don't know. I don't think it's anything. He said, you just call yourself that, and people come in and give you money to ask your opinion. Well, that's many years later. This time, anyway, Major Lundy came up to me and to Dunk Myers, and he said, I left a footlocker full of my clothes in Melbourne, and Captain So-and-so is taking the B-17 down to Melbourne for a couple of days. And, Whorehouse Harry, I want you to go down there and get it and bring it back up here for me. And Myers, you go along and help him. Well, of course, we were nothing loath to take on this duty. And we went out one morning and got in this airplane. And I remember when it took off, looking out the window there and at that huge wing and thinking this has to be the biggest airplane in the whole world. Well, it wasn't quite, but it was very big for those days, and it was very impressive. I'd never been in even a multi-engine airplane before, let alone one with four engines. And I remember that Myers and I rode a lot of the way up in the nose because we could see out. And at one time, though, we were going along there. It took several hours to get down to Melbourne. One time we were lying on the radio shack floor there, wrapped up in blankets because it was cold. And I remember old Myers looking over at me, and he says, Harry, I'll tell you. He said, war is hell. Well, we went down to Melbourne, stayed a couple days, and got Major Lundy's footlocker, and one day got in the airplane and flew back. And we flew back first to Sydney. We landed at Sydney on the way back. And Captain, whoever he was, who was flying this B-17, flew on the ground all the way back. He just buzzed every hill and everything all the way for a couple hundred miles. It was fun. And I rode most of that trip in the tail gunner's place. That had pretty good visibility. You couldn't see where you were going, but you could sure as hell see where you'd been. And the only thing wrong with it was cold back there. But I did that. And as I said, we landed. I am not telling this right. We landed at Sydney. We did not do any buzzing. He flew at some altitude up to Sydney. It was from Sydney back up to Williamtown that he buzzed all the way. Sometimes over the water, sometimes over the land, but we buzzed all the way and got back and felt we'd had a great adventure. While we were at Williamtown, which was a month or so, I'll check in a few minutes and see, but it was over a month, I think. Don Raines and I were good friends, and we shared a room in the barracks. And most every evening, it seems to me, we'd walk out to the road and get on the bus and go into town, which was Newcastle, and eat dinner in a restaurant and then go out walking on the beach or something and eventually end up going to the movies and come home late at night. And we used to do this almost every day, it seemed to me. There wasn't anything else much to do. I also remember one amusing little incident that took place at Williamtown. I had been out flying the P-39, and I came in to land. And I like to make low approaches so that I'd use all the runway. That's what they insisted on your doing. And there was a road. Well, off the end of the runway, there was some grass, and then there was a fence, and then there was a road. And at the edge of the road, by the fence, there was a little boy, probably 10 years old or something, sitting on a horse. And I came in lower, perhaps, than I intended. At least it was lower than he expected, anyway, because I remember seeing out of the corner of my eye, just as I got right there nearly, this little boy scrambling like mad down off that horse as I came in right over his head and landed. I'll never forget that little scene. We didn't do any gunnery up there at Williamtown. We didn't have any ammunition. I don't think, as I said, those planes had any guns in them anyway. Maybe they did. If they did, we certainly didn't shoot them. Most I can say about this OTU was that it was better than nothing. All right, we went there about August the 18th or 20th or something. And I'm looking now at a set of orders dated 1 October 1942 and headed, incidentally, Headquarters, 5th Air Force. And what that means is that by this time we had acquired the status of a brand new Air Force, 5th Air Force, Southwest Pacific Area, headed by a general by the name of George Kenney, K-E-N-N-E-Y, who was a very, very competent man and held in high esteem by anybody who knew anything about him, and that included General MacArthur. Anyway, these orders read, the following named officers, Air Corps unassigned, are relieved from further temporary duty at OTU No. 2, Williamtown, New South Wales, are assigned to the 49th Fighter Group, Maple, that was a code name, and will proceed on or about October 4, 1942 to Townsville, Queensland, reporting on arrival to the commanding officer, 40th Fighter Squadron, on temporary duty for additional training in aerial gunnery, and on completion thereof will proceed to Maple, I think that was Port Moresby, reporting on arrival thereat to the commanding officer, 49th Fighter Group, for assignment and duty. Now, along with me was a fellow named Arthur Wenniger, Snuffy Smith, a fellow named Jarman, Duncan Myers, Dan Moore, Bitsy Grant, Russell Francis, Bryant Wesley, I don't remember him at all, Bernard Mikowski, who was a big old lanky Polish fellow, nice guy, and Joe Littleton, who was a little old lanky guy. All right, what happened then was this. We were going to be first moved up to Brisbane. Now, there were two airfields at Brisbane, one, both of them west of the city, and one quite way west, maybe 25 miles west, called Amberley Field, and that was a big RAAF base taken over entirely by the United States at this time, but with big, long runways and loads of barracks and mess halls and the whole works. And this was the field where the Air Transport Command came in and out from the USA. And it was the main field. Then in between Amberley Field and the city of Brisbane was a small field called Eagle Farm. I don't know if it was even there in the beginning days, but later there was one. And Eagle Farm, as well as I ever could make out, was restricted entirely to a place where they assembled brand new fighter planes coming over on shipboard from the USA. And they were assembled there at Eagle Farm and tested and then flown out to their ultimate destinations. Okay, the idea was that some of us were to ferry all the flyable P-39s and all the flyable, there was only one, I guess, of those old Curtiss Falcons back up for further disposition, to Amberley Field. I should mention an incident which took place about this time, just before we left. I told you they had a brand new, almost, P-40 there. And this was still before the 5th Air Force, so the man in charge of the fighter people in Australia was, I forget what they called him, I forget his name. He was a big, tall, hawk-like, handsome man, full colonel somebody. And he came up to see us once, and stayed overnight. Well, early the next morning, Major Lundy took it into his head that he was going to give the doctor a ride in a P-40, which meant that he couldn't take a parachute and he would sit on the doctor's lap. So they got up very early in the morning before Colonel, whoever his name was, got up. And they went out and Lundy gave the doctor a ride in the P-40. But the P-40 is a very nasty airplane on the ground, either on takeoff and especially on landing. And the long and short of it was that landing it, Major Lundy ground looped it and washed out the landing gear and along with it the prop and whatever. And of course, he had sense enough to jump out. Both of them jumped out as quick as they could and ran over and grabbed the parachute and ran, put it back in the cockpit, and then went and sent for the colonel. And the colonel came out. He said to Lundy, what happened? And Lundy said, had no brake on one wheel, the colonel. No brake. Lost my brake on one wheel. Couldn't steer it. Which made sense, and the colonel bought the story. But little did he know that nice P-40 was damaged for no good reason. Of course, it wasn't a desperate thing. We didn't lose an airplane. It put a new engine and propeller on it. Be good as new, just about. Anyway, to get back to my original story, we were to ferry these airplanes up. Most people went up on the train, but I was selected by Major Lundy to fly this remaining Curtiss Falcon back up to Brisbane. It was a pretty long trip. How long, I don't know. 100, 200 miles, I suppose. And we didn't have any maps, didn't have any radio, whatever, but I got access. We had some maps on the base pinned up on the wall or something, and I kind of went and memorized this map. And figured out what I had to do. And took off. Somewhere up there, two-thirds of the way along, I suppose, you had to turn inland. I decided to follow up the coast most of the way, and then at a certain point I'd turn inland and set up a direct compass heading for Amberley Field, which, as I told you, was 25 or 30 miles inland from Brisbane. But somewhere in this process across the country, I lost my nerve and didn't. And I thought I ought to be there, and I wasn't. And I landed in a field. Rather risky, you know. But I did it. I landed in a field without any problem, and there was an old farmer there, and I went over and asked him where Amberley Field was. Well, in the first place, I couldn't understand a word he said. In the second place, I was convinced later that he didn't any more know where Amberley Field was than I did. Not as much. In fact, I doubt if he ever heard of it. Anyway, he was no help to me at all, and I took off and just took up the same course I was on and kept flying, and by golly, first thing I knew, there I was, right over the field. And I landed and delivered the airplane, and that was it. Now then, as I told you, I think, what happened at work? We got on a train, those of us who had ferried airplanes up or were left behind, or maybe we joined the rest of them, I don't know. But we got on a train and went north to Townsville, which was a big town. I don't think it's big enough to call a city, but way up north on the coast of Queensland. Hot, dry, dusty. They had a big airfield outside of town, on the west side of town, right on the edge of town. And we went up there. Now, we were, all of us, I guess, I'm sure, were temporarily assigned, as I read to you out of those orders a while back, to the 40th Fighter Squadron for gunnery practice. Now, the 40th Fighter Squadron flew P-39s, and they belonged to the 35th Fighter Group. And they had been in New Guinea, and they had been sent back down to Australia for refitting and a little bit of rest, which they badly needed. I want to give you a picture of what things were like at this time in New Guinea. In the first place, the Japanese were making out pretty well with their intention of crossing the Owen Stanley Mountains from Buna on the north coast down to Port Moresby. But by this time, a lot of those troops that we had brought over with us on the Mount Vernon were in battle on the ground trying to shove the Japanese back and keep them from getting over the mountains. Well, they didn't keep them from getting over, but they stopped them before they got to Port Moresby. That's what was going on at this moment up in New Guinea. The Air Corps people up in New Guinea were having a rough time of it. They didn't have any airplanes. They were overwhelmed by the enemy, who would come over with hundreds of planes and bomb them night and day. And they had Zeros, of course, which the P-39s were not much use against, but they did the best they could. Well, one time when we first got up to Townsville, the commanding officer, who was just a young fella in his 20s, of the 40th Fighter Squadron, to which I was now assigned, sitting around after supper one night, and I remember he had just come back from New Guinea, and everybody was asking him what it was like up there. Oh, he said, and I want to emphasize that this was not, he was not joking, he was deadly serious. Oh, he said, we've got a lot of air power up here now. We've got a lot of new airplanes, a lot of air power. And he said, it's awesome, I'll tell you. He said, I was up there, and I one day, he said, you may not believe me, but he said, I actually saw 12 B-17s all in the air at one time. And he said, it nearly darkened the sky. You have never seen a sight like this. He said it was awesome. He was serious. That's how bad things were, that he would consider seeing 12 B-17s in the air at one time as being a show of enormous air power. Some unfortunate things had taken place also, and I can't tell you much details about this because I don't know, but I know that I saw some of those guys. But the fact was that the U.S. had sent over a bunch. How many is a bunch? I don't know. Probably a group. Probably 50 or 75 airplanes. They'd sent over a bunch of brand new, out-of-the-factory B-25s. They flew them over. The crews were all raw and green, and certainly not used to flying over the Pacific Ocean. But the long and short of it was that when they arrived at Australia in the middle of the night, they were lost. Some wrecked, most of the crews just bailed out. And they lost either all or practically every one of those B-25s. Considering how critical the times were and how much even two or three airplanes would meet, to lose a whole brand new group of brand new airplanes of a type we didn't even have over there before, and a type which were eminently suited to use over there, was heartbreaking, to put it mildly. And I did talk to some of those pilots who told me about it. And of course, they had nothing. They had nothing but the clothes on their backs. That's all they had. Not a thing else. They lost everything. Okay, we were assigned, I want to try to get this in this one tape, to the 40th Fighter Squadron. The 40th Fighter Squadron, as I said, had P-39s, and they were based at a place called Anthill Plains, which was 20 or 30 miles south of Townsville, and it was out in the woods, out in the boondocks, there was nothing there but these giant fields and fields, miles of these anthills. Anthills which were 6 or 7 feet tall in many cases, and hardened in the sun like concrete. You couldn't bust one to save you. I've tried it. Well, they had cut some strips out of the brush there, dirt strips, and established a camp. And that's where we went out with the 40th Squadron, and we flew with them. They gave us a lot of formation flying practice. I don't think we ever got any gunnery practice from them. I'm sure we didn't, but we got a lot of formation flying, and that was extremely valuable. And we made a lot of new friends with people who had been in combat and knew what they were doing, and they were very nice people besides. I remember going out one night after supper with my .45, tried to kill a kangaroo. Well, I didn't succeed, and I'm very glad I didn't. To be continued.